everyone, I'm Alex, and I'm from APAW Unsolved in West Virginia. I'm a missing persons advocate with a background in criminal justice and psychology, and this channel was created to bring attention to the missing and murdered cases that deserve to be remembered. Here we talk about real people, real families, real stories that still need answers. I spend time researching these cases, speaking with families, and sharing the stories of victims from West Virginia and surrounding areas in hopes of bringing more awareness to cases that are often forgotten. Some of these families have spent years searching for answers. Some are still waiting for someone to come forward, and sometimes all it takes is one person hearing a story to make a difference. If you care about true crime, advocacy, and helping keep these cases in the public eye, make sure to subscribe to APAW Unsolved in West Virginia on YouTube and follow me on Facebook. Together, we can help make sure these stories are never forgotten.
Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case we have for you today takes us back more than 88 years to the disappearance of a young girl whose story has never faded away. Decades later, people are still asking the same haunting question. What really happened? This is the case of Marjorie West. Sunday, May 8th, 1938 was Mother's Day, and that meant it was Cecilia West's day to be celebrated. Her husband Shirley had planned this family picnic out in an area of northwest Pennsylvania known as White Gravel. Family friends Lloyd and Helen Ackland were joining them too, and the plan was simple: relax, do some fishing, eat some food, and celebrate Mom. You know, Mother's Day stuff.
So pretty much just like a little peaceful family trip.
Exactly, and at first everything was going off without a hitch. Around 3 p.m., Shirley and Lloyd have taken 7-year-old Alan fishing while Cecilia and Helen stay near the picnic area watching 11-year-old Dorothea and 4-year-old Marjorie pick flowers nearby. And apparently the girls just kept wandering further and further away because every flower they find somehow looks prettier than the last one.
That is such little girl behavior.
Right. So eventually, Dorothea decides she's going to run back and give Mom her bouquet of flowers. She's only gone for a few minutes. But when she comes back to where she left Marjorie, near this large boulder by the road, Marjorie is gone.
It's honestly terrifying.
It really is. At first, Dorothea probably thinks her sister is hiding or trying to scare her. She calls out for her a couple of times. Nothing. No response. No laughing. Nothing. And with every second that passes, that fear starts becoming very real. So Dorothea runs back to Cecilia and tells her what happened. And honestly, Cecilia reacts the same way most parents probably would at first. Maybe Marjorie wandered off, maybe she's hiding, maybe everything's just fine. But then Cecilia starts calling for her too, and she's getting nothing back either.
And let me tell you something, when my mama was hollering for me, I came running. Because if I didn't, I knew what was going to happen.
Exactly. So the calm feeling disappears fast. Panic starts setting in.
Question.
Okay.
Could Cecilia actually see where the girls have been?
According to her, yes. But there was also this huge boulder thing near the road that created kind of a blind spot. So if the girls moved behind it, even for a minute, she could have lost sight of them. But still, she keeps yelling. The more time that passes, the more frantic she gets. Eventually, her screams carry far enough that Shirley hears her from the fishing area and comes back with Lloyd and Alan. Now everyone's searching for Marjorie, but there's no sign of her anywhere. And what makes this even scarier is where all of this is happening. White Gravel sits near the Allegheny National Forest, which covered hundreds of thousands of acres.
Definitely not a place that a four-year-old should be out by herself.
Absolutely not. And remember, this is 1938. No cell phones, no flashlights sitting in your car, no emergency alerts. Everything about this search is harder. So Shirley tells Lloyd to drive to the nearest phone and call the police. He even asks him to take the other children with him because at this point he's already missing one child and he's not wanting to risk losing another. Meanwhile, other fishermen and people who were picnicking nearby realize what's happening and they start helping with the search too.
So how long before the police arrive?
They got there around 4:45 p.m. and it's not just them. Shortly after, a man named William Siffrin shows up with tracking dogs. The dogs are given one of Marjorie's raincoats to use as a scent sample, and almost immediately they start picking up her trail. They follow the exact path the girls had taken while picking flowers. They move towards the road, close to that giant boulder, and then suddenly, the dogs stop.
This isn't good.
It's not, and when William catches up to them, he sees what they found scattered in a drainage ditch nearby, the flowers Marjorie had been picking.
Nobody noticed those before.
Apparently not, but what really scares investigators is the dog's reaction, because for them, the trail ends there. No scent leading them into the woods, no scent continuing down the road, nothing. And suddenly, investigators are forced to consider something no one wanted to think about yet.
Somebody took her?
Exactly. Because if Marjorie got into a car, or was put into a car, that would explain why the scent trail stopped so abruptly. And then another detail surfaces. A couple parked nearby tells police that just after 3 p.m. they saw a dark green sedan with white license plates speeding down the road. Now, they didn't see a little girl inside. They didn't see anything obviously suspicious. It was just one man driving. But suddenly, that car feels a whole lot more important, especially if Marjorie isn't found in the woods.
Are the police waiting to roll out just her being lost before they start looking for the car that the couple described?
No, they're actually doing both, because if a car was involved, time is everything. So state police are searching in the woods, but they also post cars along Highway 219 hoping to spot that vehicle if it tries to leave the state. And that sounds like a solid plan. But again, this is 1938. The flow of information takes so long.
You know what's about to happen?
What?
It's our favorite game. Telephone!
Exactly. You have to call this person who has to call that person, who might have to physically track someone else down just to make something happen.
And legitimately, that is just assuming people are even answering their phones or if they're even where they're supposed to be.
Right. And if she's in a car, is putting someone near the state line even going to stop someone from getting out the state?
Right.
Now, one of the groups called in to help was a local CCC. Court, do you know who the CCC is?
I've heard of them, but can you remind me?
So the CCC was a Civilian Conservation Corps. During the Great Depression, it was created to employ young men who were out of work. They lived in camps, usually out in wooded areas, and their jobs were to help improve parks, forests, roads, trails, and public land.
That's really cool.
It is. A lot of stuff we take for granted in national parks today, those guys actually helped build.
I love a little side piece of history.
The important thing in the story is that there was a CCC camp in that area. It is known as Camp 3. So they get word that this little girl is missing and police need all the manpower they can get. They send men over there to join the search. The local moose and elk lodges join in too.
So just in a matter of a few hours, there's a real search party going on.
Yeah, but as night settles in, there's no sign of Marjorie. And then rain comes during the early morning hours, which slows everything down. But nobody gives up. They push through the night. By Monday morning, there was more than 500 people searching the woods.
And you know what would be amazing? Is if that many people showed up nowadays to help search for missing folks.
Right.
Hey, y'all. I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe,
and watch for deer.
Meanwhile, police are continuing to interview motorists, hoping to find anyone who might know something. And it's through those interviews that police get their first big break. A man named Floyd Burrows claims that he and another man were driving about a mile south where the West family was picnicking just after 3 p.m. on Sunday. He said his car was forced into a ditch by another vehicle speeding down the road.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Could it possibly be the same green car that the couple had seen earlier?
Good question, because I thought the same thing, but it's not super clear from the source material. I'm kind of leaning towards no. According to reports at the time, Floyd described the car as a light color. The other witness described it as dark green.
That's a teetotal difference of car colors.
Yeah, but both were driven by a man, so maybe. But it's 1938. A man driving a passing car is not exactly rare.
Honestly, in that time, basically every man drove every car.
Exactly.
License plate number.
No, they didn't get it. So again, you have another speeding car that could be the same car, but there's no way to prove it. It ends adding to the theory that Marjorie was taken away in a car, but it doesn't point directly to a specific vehicle. And it does make sense. If someone stole a child, it would explain why they were driving like a bat out of hell trying to get out of the area. But until police know for sure she was taken out of the area, they keep searching. The next day, more dogs are brought in from New York. This time, the dogs led authorities and searchers into the woods near a fishing cabin. But when they get there, nothing is found.
Are these a different kind of dog?
What do you mean?
Like, the difference between these dogs and the first dogs, are they cadaver dogs, different breeds, different agencies?
I don't think they're cadaver dogs, but I think they're still tracking dogs, just different from the first ones. I don't know the breed or anything like that either. I do know at least two of the dogs had experience tracking a small child in New York in a very similar situation.
So why or how they're different, we don't really know. They're just are?
Exactly. And I don't think they're looking for her body at this point. I think they're still trying to track where she could have gone. But I also don't know why these dogs are picking up something the first dogs didn't. There was concern that the rain could have made it harder to follow a proper scent. There was also concern that searchers themselves were causing issues with the scent trail, because you have hundreds of people moving through the woods. That can throw dogs off. At one point, they even reduced the number of searchers because of that specific concern.
Here's the thing I can't get past, though. A four-year-old couldn't have wandered far. I mean, let's face it, toddlers are quick, but they're not that quick.
Yeah.
They started looking for her right away. Now, in my mind, she could have been taken by the car.
And that makes sense. But around this time, there's another theory floating around among police and searchers. They don't necessarily believe she ran off into the woods, but they wonder, what if a bear took her?
Wouldn't they have seen evidence, though?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I'm no bear expert, but I agree with you. They started looking almost immediately. They knew she was gone within minutes. If a bear had taken her, you think someone would have heard something, seen tracks, seen damage, something.
Or heard the bear make noise. I mean, she's a 4-year-old child being attacked by a bear.
Right. And don't get me wrong, there were bears in those woods. They had been hibernating through the winter, so maybe they were hungry. Maybe people thought they could have been more aggressive. But when police search possible bear caves, they don't find anything tied to Marjorie. No remnants of clothing, no blood, no signs of her, nothing. They even send out local indigenous trackers to look for any possible bear signs, and they come up empty too. So almost as quickly as this bear theory surfaces, they do their due diligence and take it off the table. By May 11th, the mayor of Bradford, the town where the West family lived, asks for 1,000 volunteers to help search. He ends up getting 2,500 people.
That's amazing.
It really is, but it doesn't matter how many people join. Boy Scouts, National Guard, local groups, volunteers, they keep searching. And Marjorie still isn't found.
I mean, at this given point, it really starts to feel and sound she's not in the woods.
By the end of that week, after covering around 35 square miles, they have found nothing. The CCC eventually pulls their men from the searches because there's no progress. And for the first time in a week, Marjorie's father Shirley goes home. But when I say he goes home, I mean he literally eats dinner and goes back to the area to start searching again.
I can see, as a parent, why he just can't stop looking for her.
Yeah, I mean, this man was not giving up. He had basically been living and breathing that search from the moment she disappeared. And even though it looks more and more like someone took Marjorie, there is a little bit of hope in that for Shirley and the rest of her family.
Because if someone took her, there's at least that little chance that she could be still alive.
Exactly. And you know, things are really bad when you're almost hoping your child was abducted. Because compared to the idea that she got lost in the forest or was attacked by an animal, abduction at least leaves room for the possibility that she could come home.
But if she wasn't in the forest, where was she?
No one had a clue. And while the public was desperately trying to help police find her, most of the tips coming in were suspect at best. At one point, police get a call about a farmer nearby who had been seen digging what looked like a grave. So they went to investigate, and it turns out he was just planting flowers. Then there's another tip about blood being found at a hunting lodge.
I mean, it is a hunting lodge.
Exactly, but when police check it out, it's not blood. It's berry juice. And this kind of stuff just goes on for weeks. The whole time, Shirley is still out there searching, still following leads, and still beating the pavement. And Cecilia sits by the phone, unwilling to go anywhere just in case someone calls with information about her daughter.
Can't blame her at all, because I know if I was a parent and that was my child, my hand would be glued to the phone.
Same. And one day in June, it's a good thing she's there because an important call does come in. When Cecilia picks up, there's a man on the other end of the line. He says, quote, "If you want your little girl back, look for a pinkish blue 2-door sedan with the top torn. You better hurry." Then the phone just goes dead.
Where are they supposed to hurry to?
She doesn't know. Nothing about this call makes any sense.
I mean, nothing. I mean, how in the world do you even say that the car is pinkish blue?
That's the problem. There's no real accountable information besides what the car might look like. And that's even confusing. But Cecilia had to be thinking, if this call is from the kidnapper, this could be their chance to get Marjorie back. So once she gets her wits about her, she contacts the police. And even though police are pretty sure it's some kind of hoax, they tap the family's phone anyway.
They could tap phones in 1938.
They could. Like, I was shocked when I found that out. And they did. But all of June goes by, and this mysterious caller, if he was even connected to the case, never calls back. But with the new month comes new leads.
Hey, y'all. I'm Dan. and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcast.
In July, police become aware of a letter from a woman in West Virginia who claims Marjorie had been found. Now, the way police found out about this letter is secondhand. The woman doesn't write the police directly. She writes a letter to a friend of hers in Dallas. And in this letter, she says newspapers in West Virginia was reporting that Marjorie had been found alive in the state. So the friend from Dallas contacted the police, basically saying, "I don't know if any of this is true, but I saw this information and wanted to make sure you were aware of it."
I've got a serious question slash thought.
Okay.
Wouldn't the police in Pennsylvania be the first ones notified if Marjorie had been found?
I mean, that's exactly what they're thinking. How could they not know? And it's not like the information was brand new and just hadn't reached them yet. They find out the letter is more than 2 weeks old.
But, I mean, if it started with a newspaper report, can they get the paper? I mean, can they track the original source?
I don't know exactly what they did, but somehow they look into it and determine it isn't true. Marjorie hasn't been found, but the search for her continues throughout the summer. There are no major breaks in the summer, but in the fall of 1938, a couple of things happened. First, mid-October, a special investigator named C.E. Stacy travels to Thomas, West Virginia with Shirley and Cecilia. They go there because a taxi driver in West Virginia claims he saw Marjorie at a hotel with a man the night she disappeared.
You know what's really interesting?
What?
West Virginia again.
Right, because I got the letter from West Virginia too.
Like, legit, what are the odds?
I thought the same thing, but I do think it's just a possible coincidence. West Virginia shares a border with Pennsylvania, so the idea that she could have been in a nearby state isn't a huge leap.
True, but do we know what time the taxi driver said he saw her?
Around 11:30 p.m., which actually could make sense.
Does make sense. If she was taken around 3, that gives somebody plenty of time to get across the state line.
Exactly. And I looked it up. Time-wise, could work. So investigators are interested enough that they go there. They interview the taxi driver, and they also interview a hotel employee. Both of them seem pretty convinced about what they saw. A man traveling alone with a young girl who was crying. And the girl looked a lot like Marjorie. And by the way, Marjorie would have stood out. From all accounts, she resembled Shirley Temple, who was a famous child star at the time.
So, a very memorable look.
Exactly. But the problem is, even though they have this man and the girl who looked like Marjorie, the taxi driver and the hotel employee don't know who the man was. There's no digital trail, no security footage, no card transaction. Nothing like we would have today.
True, but I do have a question. Wouldn't they hand write out on a register who the man would have been?
I mean, maybe. But through whatever investigating they do, they determine that someone in Maryland might know the name of this man. Now again, how or why this person in Maryland knows, I don't know. But Shirley and Cecilia and the special investigator drive about 100 miles to Maryland. And this person gives him the name and address of the hotel guest who had been there with the little girl. His name was Conrad C. Fridley, and he lived in Ridgely, West Virginia.
Of course he does. Here it is, good old West Virginia again.
Exactly. So they go find Conrad, and when they talk to him, he tells them on the night of May 8th, he was traveling home from Parsons, West Virginia with his daughter. He says there was fog, so they stopped at a hotel in Thomas. His daughter was tired from the trip, so she got upset and was crying. Then the next day, they left and went home. And while his daughter apparently resembled Marjorie, it wasn't her.
Did they actually see this little girl?
From what I can gather, yes. I mean, at least the special investigator saw her. He said that the Fridley girl resembled Marjorie, but she wasn't Marjorie. And later census records seem to support that Fridley did have a daughter around that age. So all of that combined supports why investigators believe that Conrad was telling the truth. So that tip doesn't pan out, but it's not long before the West family is off chasing another one. On October 19th, investigators go to Lincoln Place, a neighborhood in Pittsburgh, because of another tip. This tip claims that a girl living with a family in the neighborhood could be Marjorie, but just like the last one, it turns into a wild goose chase. The girl resembles Marjorie, but it's not her. And things start getting so desperate that by late October, as small game hunting season opens in the area where Marjorie disappeared, authorities ask hunters to be on the lookout for anything that could possibly be associated with her.
So at this point, they're still considering that she could have been lost in the woods.
I think they're still open to it at this point because it's such a mystery. And honestly, I don't know that they had all the pieces, because back in 1938, there was a possibility for bigger danger that police may have not even known about. Illegal adoption operations.
A woman named Georgia Tan ran a branch of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. And what she was doing was absolutely horrific. She would convince or really trick low-income families into signing over their children. Then she would adopt them out. And when I say adopt, I'm using air quotes. Because basically, she was selling children.
And she was abducting kids too.
Yes, and sometimes she physically abducted the children herself. She would pull up in a fancy car and ask the kids if they wanted a ride. She also had people working with her who would travel around and take children that could be then sold through these illegal adoptions.
And I know we've touched on her before in another case, but Court, tell them how far her operation reached.
Most of it was based in Tennessee because that's where her political power protected her. Because it's not out of the realm of possibility that her network or networks like hers stretch much further. Over roughly 21 years, Georgia Tan was connected to thousands of stolen children. And children were adopted out as far as California and even overseas. So clearly she had money, she had access, she had the connections. The problem with the Georgia Tan theory is that there's nothing directly connecting her to Marjorie West. There's no evidence that Georgia Tan took Marjorie. There's no evidence police were even looking at her back then. And the public allegations against Tan really wouldn't explode until years later.
Right. So we're not saying Georgia Tan took Marjorie, but what we are saying is that this kind of thing was happening in that era. There were kidnapping fears. There were illegal adoption schemes. There were people stealing children. And that makes you wonder if investigators in Pennsylvania even knew how real that threat was.
Especially when information didn't travel the way that it does now.
Exactly. When police struggle to solve Marjorie's case, other people start coming out of the woodworks trying to solve it themselves.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
At one point, a private detective, from what I can gather, had nothing to do with the family, camps in the forest for a week because he believes Marjorie was killed and hidden in some type of well shaft.
Wait, why?
A good old-fashioned hunch. And I think that shows where this case is heading at this point. People were going off of hunches instead of evidence. Everyone is grasping at straws.
I mean, seriously, at that point, what else is there?
Not much. But by December of 1938, about 7 months after Marjorie's disappearance, police briefly look into a man at the urging of Shirley West. Shirley tells police that he had an argument with this person shortly before Marjorie went missing. At least according to reporting at the time, Shirley believed this man could have been a suspect. Now, where this argument took place, who the man was, and why Shirley was suspicious of him, I don't know.
I mean, was it somebody he knew?
I have no idea. That's the problem. There is almost zero details.
I mean, in all honesty, I feel that this information should have came out sooner. If Shirley felt strongly enough to point him out as a suspect.
I mean, maybe. I don't know if Shirley told police earlier and it just took them a while to track this man down. Or if by this point, Shirley is so desperate that he's pulling out any thread he can remember.
I mean, at this point, he's literally asking himself, what interactions did I have that could have possibly mattered?
Exactly. And I will say, if an argument happened at a gas station on the way to a picnic, I'd be very interested.
Right. That would have put this person close to the family, close to the timeline, and possibly give some sort of motive.
Right.
But if it happened days or weeks before, it's harder to believe that this guy would have followed them without being noticed and waited for the perfect opportunity.
Exactly. But we just don't know. What we do know is that police interviewed the man and seemed satisfied he had nothing to do with Marjorie's disappearance. They were confident they knew his whereabouts that day. So that lead goes nowhere too. And I think it shows both the police and the West family were going down every avenue they could. But eventually, they ran out of avenues. That was basically the last potential break for police. And like so many missing children's cases, Marjorie started to slowly fade from the headlines. The world moved on to the next story, but her family never did. They continued agonizing, wondering where she was, wondering what happened, and those answers never came.
Sometime in 1953, Shirley and Cecilia West separated, and both of them would die never knowing what happened to their little girl.
Over the years, people did continue to look for Marjorie. There were tips into the 2000s. Her case still caught people's interest, enough that in 2012, Pennsylvania State Police took DNA swabs from some of Marjorie's family members and sent them to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, but those results yielded no clues. Then in 2014, something strange happened. An employee at a hospital in New York claimed that a patient named Marjorie could actually be Marjorie West. For a moment, it was this huge question. Has she been found after all these years? But it was ultimately proven that the woman had been born in 1922. That would have made her 16 years old when Marjorie disappeared in 1938. So she was not Marjorie West. But there was one more major dust-up in Marjorie's case. In Harold Thomas Beck's book, Finding Marjorie West, he claims he found her. According to him, a woman told him that on her mother's deathbed, she was told the truth about who she really was. That she was in fact Marjorie West. And the story her mother supposedly told her goes like this. Basically, her father had hit Marjorie with his car that day near the picnic area. Now, how this happened without Marjorie's mother, sister, or family friends hearing or seeing anything is unclear.
Yeah, because you know how my mind operates. Hitting someone with a car is not a tiny little thing. I mean, there would be brakes, there would be screaming, there would be somebody reacting.
Exactly. And I don't have a perfect understanding of exactly where that boulder I talked about earlier was in relation to the road, or how busy or quiet that road was, but it does feel hard to believe that no one would notice that.
Especially if they are in this peaceful little picnic area, you would think a car hitting a child would stand out.
I agree, but according to the story, this man hit Marjorie with his car and thought she was probably dead, so he put her in the back seat and started racing towards a hospital. But along the way, she woke up and seemed fine. And apparently, this man and his wife had recently lost their own daughter. So instead of taking Marjorie back or bringing her to police, he took her home to their farm in North Carolina and raised her as their own.
So they just kept her.
That's the story, which again is hard to wrap your mind around. You were supposedly rushing to the hospital, and then she wakes up and suddenly you decide, well, I guess she's ours now.
This was like something DNA could very easily clear up.
I mean, you would think, but there's a catch. The woman who shared the story with Harold Beck apparently only agreed to share it under one condition, that he did not publish her story until after she died, which is what he did. So we don't know really if DNA could still be obtained, or if she has relatives who could be tested, or if anything like that would be enough to prove anything.
But if there are relatives somewhere, could they still compare DNA to the West family?
I mean, maybe. From what I can gather, the West family does not seem to believe this theory. And I think for most people, it just doesn't feel credible enough. The window of time seems too small. There's no evidence of a crash. No one heard anything. No one saw anything. But then again, so much about this case doesn't make sense.
In my book, on the roadway, there would be some sort of blood or something on there. Not just randomly, oh, well, she woke up. She was fine. I mean, no.
Exactly. You can see why this case has fascinated people for so many decades. Nothing adds up. Truly nothing.
If Marjorie West were still alive today, she would be in her 90s. As a matter of fact, she would be 93, 94 right now.
And if she's not, the mystery of what happened to her on Mother's Day in 1938 may never be solved unless someone finally comes forward. So, if you have any information on the disappearance of Marjorie West, you can contact the Pennsylvania State Police at 814-938-0510. We'll be back next week with a new episode. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find a good West Virginia true crime podcast.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.